from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's the answer. You've been wondering why Cat Stevens was pulled off that plane. Oh, I know, he was in favor of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie, and bad on him for that. See, I mean it. I mean it. I don't want a fatwa on me. But still, that was, what, 11 years ago? 13 years ago? Something like that. He must have thought... Now, I know he did reaffirm that a couple years afterwards, but still, what's he been up to lately? What's the cat been up to lately? Well, according to Time Magazine on the Internet, before I relate this to you, let me remind you, last week we shared a report which was not aired, as far as I know, elsewhere in the American media, that the Czech intelligence service is looking into that now. They agree, erroneous report, that Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 hijackers, had a meeting with an Iraqi official in Prague. This was the so-called Hussein 9/11 nexus. And as this report indicated last week, the basis for that erroneous report was the misspelling of Atta's first name. It was a confusion with another Mohammed Atta, a Pakistani businessman who spells Mohammed with three M's, unlike the hijacker who spelled it with two. All right, so now, here we are this week. Time Online reports. The former Cat Stevens was denied entry, as you know, into the United States this week when federal officials determined that he was on the government's no-fly anti-terror list. According to aviation sources with access to the list, Cat Stevens' new name is Yusuf Islam. There is no Yusuf Islam on the no-fly registry, Y-U-S-U-F. That's the way he spells it. But there is a Yusuf Islam, Y-O-U-S-S-O-U-F. I'm not kidding you, ladies and gentlemen. The incorrect name was added to the register this summer, but because Islam's name is spelled Y-U-S-U-F on his British passport, he was allowed to board the plane in London. That explains why he got on the plane in the first place. The Transportation Safety Administration alleges that Yusuf Islam has links to terrorist groups. He denies it. British Foreign Minister Jack Straw said the U.S. action, quote, should never have been taken, unquote. It's a war, ladies and gentlemen, as soon as we learn how to spell their names. Hello, welcome to the show. That's why we liked Hitler. As an enemy, I mean.
Sitting eating an apple one day under the apple tree, and the apple tastes so good to me, ate up the apple tree. Come on, see about me. Come on, see about me. Come on, see about me. Ate up the apple tree. Come on, see about me. Come on, see about me. Eat up the apple tree. Adam in the garden eating an apple one day. Juice come running out. That's when me and you and everybody else found out what love was all about. Come on, see about me. Come on, see about me. Come on, see about me. Eat up the apple tree.
to me. Eat up your apple tree. Come on, see about me.
Come on, see about me.
Was the summer I turned 18. We lived in a one-room rundown shack on the outskirts of New Orleans. We didn't have money for food or rent, to say the least, we were hard-pressed. Then Mama spent every last penny we had to buy me a dancing dress. Mama washed and combed and curled my hair, and she painted my eyes and lips. And then I stepped into a satin dancing dress that was split on the side, cleaned up to my hips. It was red velvet trim and it fit me good. And staring back from the looking glass was a woman where a hat grew kid and stood. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Lord, forgive me for what I do, please. But if you want out, well, it's up to you. Now don't let me down, your mom's gonna help you move uptown. Mama dabbed a little bit of perfume on my neck and she kissed my cheek. And I saw the tears well up in her troubled eyes when she started to speak. She looked at a pitiful shack and then she looked at me and took a ragged breath. Your paw's run off and I'm real sick and the baby's gonna starve to death. She handed me a heart-shaped locket that said, to thine own self be true. And I shivered as I watched a roach crawl across the toe of my high-heel shoe. It sounded like somebody else that was talking, asking, Mama, what do I do? And just be nice to the gentleman, Fancy, and they'll be nice to you. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. The last time I saw my ma, the night I left that rickety shack. Cause the welfare people came and took the baby. Mom died and I ain't been back. But the wheels of fate had started to turn, and plead there was no way out. And it wasn't very long till I knew exactly what my mom had been talking about. I did what I had to do, but I made myself a solemn vow that I was gonna be a lady someday, though I didn't know when. I couldn't see spending the rest of my life with my head hung down in shame. I might have been born just plain white trash, but Fancy was my name. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. It wasn't long after a benevolent man took me in off the street. And 1 week later, I was pouring his tea in a five-room hotel suite.
Yes, you were. Well,
I charmed a king, a congressman, and an occasional aristocrat. And I got me a Georgia mansion in an elegant New York townhouse flat. And I ain't done that.
Yes,
self-righteous hypocrites that would call me bad and criticize my mama for turning me out, no matter how little we had. And though I ain't had to worry about nothing for now 15 years, I can still hear the desperation in my poor mama's voice ringing in my ear. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Uptown, and I guess she did.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Yeah, back in the Le Show Dome, where it belongs. With big new speakers. Hey, please give. Ladies and gentlemen, we now know that the one thing the Bush administration stands four square against is mixed messages. That's what President Bush has been saying all this week. That's been sort of his mantra in criticizing Senator Kerry. As Senator Kerry has stepped up the criticism of the war in Iraq, President Bush has said, and so has Prime Minister Alawi,
"It's all right. It's all right."
That's, he said it. That mixed messages are what hurt. We don't want to send mixed messages. So now listen to these messages. Dateline, September 24th. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the U.S. has sufficient troops to handle its current missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as others that may arise. Dateline, September 26th. September 25th. The United States could begin to withdraw troops from Iraq before the country is at peace, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld suggested on Friday after meeting with Alawi. Any implication that place has to be peaceful and perfect before we can reduce coalition and U.S. forces would obviously be, I think, unwise, because it has never been peaceful and perfect, and it isn't likely to be, Rumsfeld said. Dateline, September 25th. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld acknowledged Thursday that more U.S. troops may have to be sent to Iraq to provide security for January elections that are threatened by a wave of insurgent violence. So let's review here. The U.S. has sufficient troops to handle its current missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. could begin to withdraw troops from Iraq before the country is at peace, and more U.S. troops may have to be sent to Iraq to provide security for January elections. That's not a mixed message, ladies and gentlemen. That is a coterie. And the head of the United Nations Commission organizing... Oh, well, wait a minute. First, we have to have this, because this is the message to mix all messages. This is Secretary Rumsfeld this week on elections scheduled for January, or as Colin Powell put it late Sunday morning on one of the TV Yak shows, late January.
Let's pretend hypothetically that you get to election time in January, and let's pretend that it's as roughly like it is or a little worse, which it could be. And let's say you tried to have an election and you could have it in three quarters or four fifths of the country, but some places you couldn't because the violence was too great. Well, that's, so be it. Nothing's perfect in life. So you have an election that's not quite perfect. Is it better than not having an election? You bet.
What's good for Florida is good for Iraq. Hey, they had elections in Iraq before. Hussein got 99% of the vote. That wasn't a perfect election, but it was an election. Was it better than no election? You bet. The head of the United Nations Commission organizing January's national election in Iraq criticized comments made by Rumsfeld. He said Rumsfeld should not have made those comments. The commission has found so far that it hasn't been helpful speculating whether certain parts of the country will be able or not to participate in the election. Unquote. And not to suggest that it's only striped pants bureaucrats at the UN that are criticizing Rumsfeld messages, messaging techniques. Deputy Secretary of State in our own very government, Richard Armitage, said we're going to have an election in Iraq that is free and open, that it has to be open to all citizens. It's got to be our best effort to get it into troubled areas as well, Armitage said. We absolutely want to hold them in all parts of Iraq. Asked if partial election, he said, asked if partial elections were under consideration, he said, no, not now, not that I know of. Unquote. It's called compartmentalization, Dick. Look into it. You'll find it really interesting. Not that I know of, sir, at this point in time. Hey, accountability is all the rage. That's why it's interesting to note that internal reviews underway at the Central Intelligence Agency and recently completed at the Justice Department, examining their performance in the run-up to 9/11, have not resulted in any disciplinary action whatsoever. Because you got to be accountable. If you're a school teacher and make $85,000 a year, A bitter political struggle has erupted over control of the special Iraqi tribunal set up to try Saddam Hussein, according to the New York Times. Prime Minister Alawi and his rivals maneuvering for influence over the appointment of judges. Hey, they got that democracy thing right. The timing of trials, the scope of charges, and even who will stand trial and who will escape the death penalty by cutting deals with prosecutors. That battle burst into the open this week when Salam Chalabi accused Dr. Alawi of dismissing him, Chalabi, only 5 months into a 3-year term, so as to take, quote, political control of the tribunal. This good man taking political control of the tribunal. Other interesting news about Iraq this week that you may not have heard because of the bubblicious atmosphere in which we operate. Operations by U.S. and multinational forces and Iraqi police are killing twice as many Iraqis as attacks by insurgents. Most of the Iraqis killed by the U.S. and multinational forces, according to this report, are civilians, according to statistics compiled by the Iraqi Health Ministry. We got them up, standing up, just in time. According to the ministry, the interim Iraqi government recorded 3,487 Iraqi deaths in 15 of the country's 18 provinces. Are those the 15 that are safe, according to Alawi? It could be a different 15. Between April 5th, when the ministry began compiling the data, and September 19th. So that's what, 4 or 5 months? 3,400 deaths. Of those, 328 were women and children. Another 13,000 Iraqis were injured. Most of the dead are believed to be civilians. The data do include an unknown number of police and Iraqi National Guardsmen. Many Iraqi deaths, especially of insurgents, are never reported. So the actual number of Iraqis killed in fighting could be significantly higher. This is according to Knight Ridder newspapers. And the U.S. blames the insurgents for living in residential areas. Rome's Dateline Rome, this would be, I guess, tit for tat with Dennis Hastert and a few other Republicans suggesting that Al-Qaeda wants John Kerry to win the presidential election here in the United States. Britain's ambassador to Italy called President George W. Bush Al-Qaeda's, quote, best recruiting sergeant, unquote. So it's even, I guess. This is according to Italian media this week. A comment was made at a closed-door conference last weekend. It was denounced by one leading Italian newspaper editor, who issued an open letter criticizing the ambassador, Sir Ivor Roberts. Roberts was quoted as telling an annual Anglo-Italian gathering in Tuscany, hey, count me in. Can I come? I know I'm not Anglo or Italian, but I know people who... Tuscany! I'm... Quote, if anyone is ready to celebrate the eventual re-election of Bush, it's Al-Qaeda, unquote, British Ambassador Ivor Roberts. Roberts also told the meeting, quote, Bush is Al-Qaeda's best recruiting sergeant, unquote. The British Embassy in Rome declined to comment. An outspoken conservative newspaper editor and a former spokesman for the Italian prime minister wrote in an open letter saying he would boycott a previously scheduled dinner with the ambassador. Quote, the dinner unfortunately would be a complete waste of time, unquote. Hey, not if you're hungry. You always can be hungry. British officials gave warning more than 2 years ago. Now, the other thing that President Bush criticized John Kerry for this week was suggesting that Ayad Alawi, the interim, when we describe him, prime minister of Iraq, was being less than complete in his accounting of the security situation in Iraq. And Bush said, oh, it's outrageous to criticize this good man. So let's get outside the bubble, where British officials gave warning more than 2 years ago that Ayad Alawi, the interim Iraqi prime minister, was seen as, quote, a Western stooge, unquote, who lacked domestic credibility, unquote, according to secret documents seen by the conservative British newspaper, The Telegraph. The cabinet office told ministers of government a year before the war that the external opposition, made up of Alawi's Iraqi National Accord and Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress, was, quote, weak, divided, and lacks domestic credibility. Doesn't mean they can't hire maids. It means credibility inside Iraq. Alawi, who was closely aligned with the CIA, and Chalabi, were regarded by most Iraqis as, quote, Western stooges, according to a secret UK eyes-only paper by the British government, our strongest ally. A coup attempt in 1996, allegedly organized by Alawi, a neurosurgeon, in tandem with the CIA, ended in wholesale executions, according to the paper. The paper also describes Chalabi as, quote, a convicted fraudster popular on Capitol Hill, unquote. But that's just the Brits, and that's just a secret paper. Meanwhile, as they like to say, meanwhile down under, somebody else knew. Somebody else wasn't fooled in the run-up to the war. Somebody else wasn't on the train. Australia's leading expert on weapons of mass destruction defied political and bureaucratic walls to warn the Australian Prime Minister that his case for war against Iraq was based on falsehoods and it would make Australia a bigger terrorist target. Bob Matthews, a 35-year veteran of the Defense Science and Technology Organization, wrote privately to Prime Minister John Howard 3 days before Howard committed Australia to the war. The expert was repeatedly blocked by his superiors from expressing his views. He was a prince. He was just, here's all he was, ladies and gentlemen. You'd block him, too, from expressing his views. He was just the principal research scientist for weapons of mass destruction and arms control at the Defense Science and Technology Organization when he wrote the letter. He just has an international reputation in WMD and counterterrorism. Why would you let him? Why would you want to know what he thinks? The lengthy critique by Dr. Matthews in his letter called on the Prime Minister to reconsider his position and take action to dissuade the U.S. from its path. In the letter, he said there was not even circumstantial evidence to back the view that Saddam Hussein had substantial stockpiles of usable WMD. If he did have WMD, according to Matthews, the chances of it being passed into terrorist hands was a, quote, high probability should Iraq be invaded. He wrote he believed there was no chance of it falling into al-Qaeda hands as long as Saddam remained in power. He also noted Australia would face an increased risk of terrorist acts if it joined the invasion, which was, quote, quoting Dr. Matthews, a serious distraction to the fight against terrorism, unquote. There are no reasons at the present time, he wrote 3 days before Australia committed to the war, to justify supporting a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, unquote. Howard has denied that, I think he denied something. I don't recall what he exactly denied. Dr. Matthews wrote the letter to Howard in a personal capacity because he'd been thwarted for several months by senior figures in the Defense Science and Technology Organization from relaying his concerns up the chain of command. He faced reprisals after he sent the letter, including having his top secret security clearance frozen while he was investigated. He also had his travel abroad restricted, while senior officials, government officials, considered prosecuting him for passing on classified material. He remains at the organization. He's overseas. He's out of Australia. Maybe he's here. Maybe he's in Santa Monica. Hey, Dr. Matthews, Dr. Bob, how you doing? Now, ladies and gentlemen, enough of the past. Let's get to the present and the apologies of the week. And good ones, too. This one, of course, must come first.
How could you have been so misled that these documents were put on TV?
I made a mistake. I didn't dig hard enough, long enough, didn't ask enough of the right questions. And I trusted a source who changed his story. It turns out he misled us, lied to us about one thing. But there are no excuses. This is not a day for excuses. I made a mistake. We made a mistake, and I'm sorry for it.
Do you feel betrayed?
Sorry?
Do you feel betrayed? Betrayed by your source?
No. No. I'm sorry I didn't use the word. No. I feel sorry that we made a mistake. I, Well, if I had known then what I know now, I wouldn't have included the documents in the report. But I didn't know then what I know now. But again, no excuses. This was a mistake, and I really regret it.
Hurricane Dan blowing the other way. By the way, before we continue with the apologies, just a note of irony. Because of that imbroglio over inauthentic documents, here's the story that 60 Minutes was going to present that night and got bumped for the story about Bush and the National Guard. 60 Minutes was going to present a story about the faked documents the U.S. relied upon in arguing that Iraq was seeking to buy uranium from the African country of Niger. CBS has now decided not to broadcast that story until after the election, thinking it would be inappropriate to broadcast a story critical of the president before the election. So a story that CBS had based on inauthentic documents trumped a story that CBS had about the government basing part of its argument for war on inauthentic documents. Irony in the news, ladies and gentlemen. Now back to the apologies. Waitress Audra Murphy was appalled when she learned about a new makeup requirement at Ruby Tuesday in Hanover, Pennsylvania. Supervisors began enforcing the policy which required female servers to wear lip gloss, mascara, and eyeshadow in August. Murphy decided to protest the policy by showing up for work without makeup. Women were told to put on their, quote, date face. It was a corporate policy being enforced by high-level managers. After she and some of her fellow complainants appeared on Good Morning America, the company issued a statement of apology. We apologize for the way the previous policy was implemented, and we have corrected the guidelines from requiring makeup to strongly recommending it, the statement said. Statement emailed from Ruby Tuesday, Executive Vice President Richard Johnson said the company sets very high standards not only for our food and facilities, but also for our employees. Let's put makeup on the food. Muskegon, Michigan County emergency officials, and along with school and hospital personnel, held a mock terrorist exercise this week. A domestic terrorist group dubbed Wackos Against Schools and Education planted a bomb on a public school bus loaded with students. According to materials handed out to explain the fake scenario, the, quote, wackos believe everyone should be homeschooled. But local officials were deluged with phone calls and emails from across the nation complaining about the choice of words. I believe they apologized. Yes, the Muskegon Area Intermediate School District issued a statement saying the organization was not aware of the scenario but nevertheless apologized. Said it shared the disappointment of others when we learned the emergency preparedness drill referenced homeschoolers as the fictitious group responsible for a mock disaster. We apologize. British rock star Elton John has apologized for losing his cool at Taipei's airport, but says Taiwan's news photographers and TV crews are the rudest people he's met. The singer shouted expletives at the photogs and called them vile pigs, but at a concert later he apologized for the flare-up. He said his tirade wasn't directed at the Taiwanese people. Is there such a thing as the Taiwanese people? I thought they were all Chinese, Eldon. You may have to apologize for that. Or not. The store that's been selling a controversial T-shirt in Ontario, Canada, has issued a public apology. The manager of Cherry Bomb Apparel said she and her staff regretted the attention and controversy caused by the offending shirt. Although we believe in freedom of speech, it was never our intent to offend anyone, said Kristen Fowl. The shirts featured a bloody hammer with the caption, quote, she was asking for it. Earlier this week, Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty called the shirt reprehensible. Fowl said the shirts are all gone. She's decided not to reorder them. The shop also sold a woman's version, which had an image of bloody scissors and the caption, he had it coming. Shop apologized, I guess, for all of them. A police commander said the tear gassing of a neighborhood in Tallahassee where children were playing was unintended, and the police commander apologized to residents. Police department's TAC team, similar to a SWAT team, were doing training exercises in an abandoned home. The team had permission from the owner to use the property for practice. As they were finishing, one of the officers discharged a tear gas canister. The gas wafted about 100 yards to a row of homes on a dirt road nearby where children were playing. Kimberly Williamson Butler accepted partial responsibility for an Election Day debacle in New Orleans. She apologized to New Orleans voters who were turned away from 90 polling places because voting machines weren't delivered on time. She pointed the finger at Covan Worldwide Moving, the Alabama company that holds a state contract to deliver the machines. "We wouldn't be here today," she said at her afternoon news conference, "if the drivers had shown up." Nevada Comptroller Kathy Augustine has been fined $15,000 for making staffers do her campaign work on state time. She now faces impeachment proceedings. She apologized for her conduct after the State Ethics Commission issued its decision, but said she won't resign. She and her lawyers declined to make any further comment. The chancellor of the University of Nebraska says this: "Comments I made in a recent newspaper story could reasonably have been interpreted as an attack on community colleges and those who advance their education in that way. These remarks were not fully reflective of my views." He apologized. Bobby Gordon apologized this week for intentionally causing an accident at New Hampshire International Speedway that involved championship contenders Tony Stewart and Jeremy Mayfield. Gordon was angered 17 laps, who's counting, into Sunday's race when Greg Biffle caused him to spin. He did a Biffle spin. A Biffle-caused spin. He biffled him. After radioing to his crew that he would retaliate, he made good on the threat by intentionally wrecking Biffle later in the race. Stewart and Mayfield could not avoid the accident, and their cars were both severely damaged. "First and foremost, I feel terrible for Jeremy Mayfield, Tony Stewart, their team sponsors, and car owners Joe Gibbs and Ray Evernham," Gordon said in his apology. "I allowed my frustration with Biffle to affect two other teams, both of which have great shots to win a championship, and for that, I am sorry." He admitted when he wrecked Biffle, he was trying to even the score. I guess he won't get a DITAC endorsement contract. Magnolia, Texas residents face an unexpected 8-cent hike in property taxes this year. Council members learned this week they believe they voted in August to maintain last year's tax rate, but the rate actually adopted was 8 cents higher. On Tuesday, council members considered adopting an ordinance that restored the rate back down, but tabled the motion after debating the costs associated with that action. "We apologize to the public," said Councilman Dave Sutherland, "because we didn't intend for this to happen." President Bush's, this isn't so important, President Bush's chief domestic security official, Tom Ridge, apologized for the disruption of a big intelligence and police surveillance operation in Britain. He said the leaking of intelligence in the U.S. about alleged terrorist suspect in Britain was, quote, regrettable, unquote. British government was furious early last month when individuals were named and allegations about terrorist attacks were made public in the U.S. The disclosures forced the police to quickly arrest 12 suspects in raids across England. Regrettable. And finally, evangelist Jimmy Swaggart apologized this week for saying in a televised worship service that he would kill any gay man who looked at him romantically. A complaint was filed with a Canadian broadcasting group, and Swaggart said his Baton Rouge-based Jimmy Swaggart Ministries has received complaints from gay groups over the remarks made. He was discussing his opposition to gay marriage when he said, "I've never seen a man in my life I wanted to marry, and I'm going to be blunt and plain. If one ever looks at me like that, I'm going to kill him and tell God he died," Swaggart said to laughter and applause from the congregation. This week, Swaggart said he has jokingly used the expression killing someone and telling God he died thousands of times about all sorts of people. He said the expression is figurative, not meant to harm. "It's a humorous statement that doesn't mean anything. You can't lie to God. It's ridiculous," Swaggart told the Associated Press. If it's an insult, I certainly didn't think it was, but if they are offended, then I certainly offer an apology. Unquote. Jimmy Swaggart. Ladies and gentlemen, the Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this, and I don't think any other broadcast. I don't think Keith has copyrighted it. Ladies and gentlemen, some of the reality shows that are dominating primetime airwaves are written. They have scripts, which are called in the trade paper cuts. Jokes are written for hosts, banter for judges, plot points and narrative arcs are developed. In some cases, lines are fed directly to contestants. The reality stories have a beginning, middle, and end, shaped by writers who are called not writers, but story editors or segment producers, who use the expression Frankenbites to describe the art of switching around contestant sound bites recorded at different times and patched together to create what appears to be a seamless narrative. But the writers on those shows are not represented by the Writers Guild of America. Reality shows are profitable and cheap to produce because they don't pay their contestants and they don't pay union scale for writers or directors or the crews. Now the Writers Guild is going after them. And simultaneously, a California appeals court has revived an age discrimination lawsuit brought by the Writers Guild against major TV networks and studios. The lawsuits claim that the powerful entertainment companies and agencies discriminate against writers over age 40. Trying to appeal to youth, they allege that so-called grays can't come up with ideas that appeal to youth. Boy, it sounds like these two facts, these two problems, can be so easily solved.
I'm Casey Kasem. You know, some people might say I'm too old to host a reality TV show. But take it from the Kaser. This isn't your father's reality show. Or your son's. This is The Room. Forget about exotic islands, swanky mansions, or the gilt-edged offices of billionaires. Each week, you're stuck in room 212 in building 47 West, somewhere in Studio City. Sitting around this conference table, piled high with half-eaten pizzas and half-drunk diet sodas, your task is to stay employed as a writer for this very show. You're playing against your fellow writers. This is The Room.
I'm Stan. I'm a sexy bartender. I've done some writing for Maxim, and I've got a bad divorce settlement with an ex-starlet to pay off, so here I am. I'm on the black team.
I'm Pete. I was showrunner on a big hit, but my last three pilots didn't sell, and in the meantime, I came out, and I'm on the black team.
I'm Mark. I quit the business and moved back to Illinois in 1980, but I got bored. I'm on the gray team.
I'm Arlene. I did stand-up as the ugly wife, you know, the bit. And I wrote the hit TV show for the comic who stole my act. I'm here to get even, and I'm on the gray team.
Okay, listen up, gang. Here's this week's first challenge. A surprise guest star has to be worked into the reality storyline.
We know, Casey. We wrote it.
But you don't know that the surprise guest star is Mary Kay Letourneau. Good luck.
Mary Kay who?
You know, the teacher who...
What are we supposed to do with her?
I've got an idea. Let's see if there's money in the budget for a young male intern.
Now that's funny.
I'm serious.
Okay, as you know, every week we meet here in Jerry's Deli for the winnowing. Mark, you voted to fire Stan.
Yeah, his idea for us to have to figure out how to roast a live pig in the room was just stupid and cost too much. And he didn't even know who Mel Tolkien was.
Pete, you voted to fire Arlene.
Yeah, well, I didn't think making us all go to Lohman's to shop for show outfits was even close to good TV.
Arlene?
At least we'd have new clothes.
16 writers. 8 on the black team, 8 on the gray. Only one ends up getting credit. Plus $50,000 up front and 1/10 of a point of net profits as we define them. This is The Room.
The Room. Reality was never this real. Wednesdays this fall on UPN. We're what the wrestlers watch.
from the kitchen in a bar in Tel Aviv. He asks for my age. He thinks I'm a virgin. That's why he asks for me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody come get me. I dream of my country. I think of my mother. I send her what I can. She thinks I'm a waitress. She's proud I'm a waitress in the promised land. They promised me work and they promised me TV. They promised I'd never get bored. I'm back on the stairway, I'm higher than ever. They promised that I could get more. Somebody's missing me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody come get me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody come get me. There's a boat down on the shore. Wish I could steal away. One, two, Sophia, she's running and laughing out loud. Down by the river, in the middle of summer, I wish he'd get off of me now. Somebody's missing me, somebody's missing me, somebody come get me.
Ladies and gentlemen, the past is the past. We've pointed out before how futile it is to go back and hear people, what people used to say before they, I was about to say flip-flop. Dick Cheney, May 20th, 1992, explaining why it was a bad idea for the U.S. to have gone forward in Gulf War I and deposed Saddam Hussein. How many additional American lives is Saddam worth? Not very damn many, Dick Cheney said. I don't know, referring to invading, going all the way to Baghdad to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Cheney continued, I don't know how we would have let go of that tar baby once we had grabbed hold of it, unquote, Dick Cheney, May 20th, 1992. I know, that's explainable because at that time, that was much closer in time to when Saddam Hussein actually did have weapons of mass destruction. And here is Richard Perle, the not yet quite disgraced Richard Perle, a year ago, talking about a year later.
And a year from now, I'll be very surprised if there is not some grand square in Baghdad that is named after President Bush.
Well, you're surprised, or you're a grand square. I don't know, one of the two. Ladies and gentlemen, you know that what's going on this weekend is debate prep. George W. Bush, John Kerry, preparing for their first presidential debate to be held this Thursday. Their surrogates, meantime, are playing the expectation game, trying to lower the expectations for their candidate's success and raise the expectation for their opponents. It's childish. Not very interesting, but, you know, you got to do something to bide the time till Thursday. Unless you're on the phone.
Struggling Eagle.
No, that's not your real code name today, is it? 43?
I don't know, 41. Feels like it should be.
No, what's the problem, Sprout? No, you don't pay attention to the polls. None of us do, but you're leading in all of them.
Yeah, but even though you're right, don't pay attention to them. If you look at the internals, right track, wrong track is still worse here than in Iraq, for Pete's sake. That can't be good for me.
Saw that you said it was better in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Didn't think you meant it.
See, here's what I don't understand. How long is it going to take my own father to understand that when I say something, I mean it, unless it's specifically corrected on a late Friday afternoon? See, we're different that way.
Sprout told you this before. Yeah. Any politician who means everything he says isn't saying enough. But debate prep must be cheering you up.
Well, your friend and mine, Jim Baker, is doing his best not to cheer me up.
Well, it's not my job.
He says it's not his job.
Well, he's gotten you this far. Maybe he's worth a listen or two.
See, I want to take the gloves off, really debate like I really can, and, you know, admit that I read newspapers, the whole deal.
Uh-huh. And Bake says?
He says if it ain't broke, you don't own it.
Don't fix it.
I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's right.
I'll show you. Look, just a second here.
Okay, Mr. President, are you confident in saying that Iraqi elections will be held on schedule in January?
See, this just isn't me.
Sir, please, I'm late for a deposition on the Saudi deal.
Okay. See, I believe that the Iraqi elections were scheduled in January by higher power than either Mr. Alawi or myself. See, so far no problem, but...
Just go ahead.
And so we're going to grant that power the abidement that it deserves. See, there's no such word as abidement.
Yeah, well, people know what you mean. See, that's the important part.
I don't know, 41. The whole thing is getting me down, you know. I mean, sometimes late at night, I watch one of John Kerry's speeches where he's tearing down all we're trying to build, and I just think, hey, what's the use?
Yeah, well.
And then I feel I'm working so hard in front of those crowds, and then I see a tape of Dick Cheney, and... You know, the guy barely breaks a sweat, and he's got him cheering, so... I don't know.
Son, I've disagreed with you on virtually everything that we've been careful enough not to discuss, but know you well enough to know you believe in what you're doing.
Yeah, I know, but is that enough?
Oh, sure it is. You're putting your opponent in the position of attacking a faith-based presidency. That's one step better than what I did, just wrapping myself in the flag. You're wrapping yourself in on the...
Like, I know everyone has moments when they begin to look in the mirror and doubt the mirror and themselves.
Of course you do.
But I never thought... It would happen to me.
Hey, 43, you're in the hands of professionals. You're more locked on message than one of those robot typewriters. you got more money to spend than the other guy. And you're a Bush.
Well,
don't like to say it, but there it is.
41, you know something?
What's that?
I know we disagree on the ways that I've redeemed your presidency, but you just reminded me of some important truths. And, you know, every once in a while, it's important for me to
hear that from someone other than the big fella upstairs. I owe you big time.
Hey, every decade or so, do something right, I guess.
But look, Bakes double parked. Yeah. I'll talk to you after the debate.
All right, give him hell, 43.
Well, I sure don't want it. Tell Mom I said, hey.
Will do.
Meanwhile, there's other debate prep.
Okay, I'm speaking, or I'm I'm at least making a good faith effort to... Ow!
Try it again, sir.
My friends, I'm engaged in a valiant... Ow! Mary Beth, I think the voltage is turned up too high. These really sting.
Good.
What?
These really sting. That was a three-word sentence. It's working. Go on, try it again.
Okay. Good. Here's, in a nutshell, what I'm doing. I'm speaking in relatively short, by which I mean... Damn! All right, just a second here.
Just really hone in on what you're saying.
I know. I'm speaking in short sentences.
Good. Say it again.
I'm, as must be obvious now, to... I'm speaking in short, which is not to say unmeaning... I'm speaking in short sentences.
You want to take a little break?
No, let's press on through these. Mm-hmm. I'm asking for you, the American people, to trust...
You're asking for their vote. That's all.
Right. I'm asking... No, I'm beseeching... Here is what I am and what I am not.
Ladies and gentlemen, during remarks in New Hampshire this week, President Bush said the late terrorist Abu Nidal had killed Leon Klinghoffer, who died after being tossed off the hijacked cruise liner Achille Lauro in 1985. Do you remember Abu Nidal? Bush asked the crowd. He's the guy that killed Leon Klinghoffer. He repeated the mistake Monday evening at a campaign event in New York City. Abu Nidal was a cold-blooded terrorist killer who killed Leon Klinghoffer, said President Bush. Actually, it was Abul Abbas, the leader of a violent Palestinian group, who killed Klinghoffer. The White House had no immediate comment on the mix-up. Nor did Cat Stevens. Ladies and gentlemen, let's fight the next war against people whose names we can remember. This concludes this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time. Over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world via the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America, via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it on your computer, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow. And it would be just like keeping our abus from our abus if you could agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at kinterworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks for their help on today's broadcast. Le Show playlists usually available at harryshearer.com. Show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Abu, everybody.